You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy won, Candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and Teamsters Local 41. United Auto Workers Local 249, members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. And Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, ADAPT took hundreds to D.C. twice to break the back of Trump Care. They succeeded. Hear about it on tonight's show. Then, isn't it about time to bring all the railroad craft unions together to work on common issues? We'll talk to one union leader from the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way who is trying to bring the crafts together while fighting for better contracts. In the news, mandatory arbitration and a ban on class actions by non-union workers heard by pro-business Supreme Court. And Heartland Labor Forum wins twice in labor media contest. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. She'll talk about West Virginia's senior senator opposing the mine safety pick. Also about how OSHA has cited a Chicago container manufacturer for injuries and amputations, and finally, dairy workers suffocating in manure. Yuck. Now for the news. The news from our site, October 5th, 2017. The Nation magazine reported on Tuesday about the Supreme Court hearing on Epic Systems versus Lewis, a case that will affect the rights of millions of workers to bring class action cases against their employers for violating basic labor laws, and it's not looking good. One of the plaintiffs works for a Murphy Oil gas station in Alabama. She is required to check competing gas stations' prices every day before and after work, but isn't paid for the time she spends doing it. She joined other employees who are getting shafted on wages to sue her employer, but the individual contract that she had signed when she was hired prohibits class action lawsuits and requires arbitration. In past cases on compulsory arbitration and class action waivers, the Supreme Court has been fiercely split. In Tuesday's oral arguments, they were still divided. Justices Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg all appeared to favor letting workers sue collectively, but Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts appeared to be on the employer's side. Neil Gorsuch, the new guy, was silent, as was Clarence Thomas, but he unfailingly sides on the boss's side. That leaves Justice Kennedy, who is usually in the middle, but on Tuesday appeared to be leaning to the right. The Economic Policy Institute says 56.3% of non-union private sector employees are currently subject to mandatory arbitration agreements. And of those, 41% have also waived their right to a class action claim. Put simply, an estimated 24.7 million American workers have been barred from bringing a class action claim to defend their employment rights. The Nation magazine concludes that a ruling in favor of employers would decimate employees' ability to sue for wage and hour and discrimination claims, and many labor advocates fear the worst.
Business Insider reports on a Starbucks shareholder resolution calling on the company to change its family leave policy. On Monday, a group of shareholders led by Zevin Asset Management filed a resolution to express concern with the company's unequal paid parental leave policy. While Starbucks corporate offices have extensive maternity and paternity leave policies, these policies do not include in-store workers. Corporate employees can receive up to 18 weeks of paid maternal leave, and fathers or adoptive parents receive up to 12 weeks of paid leave. However, in-store workers receive just 6 weeks of paid maternal leave. Adoptive parents can request up to 6 weeks of paid leave. Starbucks' response mainly shows how bad the entire industry is on employee benefits, especially for part-time employees who are the norm among fast food workers and baristas. Reggie Borges of Starbucks performed a classic pivot when told Business Insider that the company is one of the few to provide hourly employees full benefit eligibility at only 20 hours a week. He said, "We offer a more robust benefits package than any other retail company. With respect to our new parental leave benefit, this will be exceptional within the retail industry, not only because of paid time off component, but also because it offered to anyone who works just 20 plus hours or more a week, and there is no tenure requirement attached to it. So Starbucks is better than others. Congrats for that." But Borges totally ducked the question of why the headquarters employees get better benefits than baristas.
Josh Adelson in Bloomberg uncovered new charges by the United Auto Workers against Nissan Motor Company for illegally tracking and rating employees by their union sentiments for years at the Mississippi Assembly Plant, where workers voted down union representation last month by a margin of 2-1. In an amended complaint filed September 19th with the National Labor Relations Board, the union alleges the automaker continues to maintain an employee surveillance, data collection, and rating system that records employee union activity and rates workers according to their perceived support for or opposition to the UAW. In the complaint, which Bloomberg News obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request, the UAW asks the NLRB to subpoena the automaker and investigate its claims. The UAW blames its loss in the union election on intimidation from the company, which it has alleged to the NLRB included threatening to close the plant, questioning employees, and infringing on unions' access to voters. The UAW submitted a partially redacted document to the NLRB that, it said, is evidence of Nissan's rating system. The union said the document lists names and employee numbers along with comments such as, quote, "has talked with solicitors at the gate before a shift," unquote, and, quote, "has been seen hanging out with pro-union technicians," unquote. If true, such worker surveillance is reminiscent of the armies of spies employed by both Ford and General Motors in the 1930s before the UAW was successful in organizing auto workers.
The Heartland Labor Forum is once again proud to announce that it has won awards in two categories in the Film and Broadcast Contest of the International Labor Communications Association for Broadcast in 2016. We won first place in the category Best Long-Form Audio for a show on July 14th, which asks, do Harley's dreams of personal freedom extend to its workers? On that show, Judy Ansel interviewed Kevin Amos and Brett Farr, union presidents at Harley of Machinists Local 176 and Brett Farr, president of Steelworkers Local 760. The show explored how Harley, once a blue-collar Made in America icon famous for its cooperative management system, which supposedly empowered workers and respected unions, has reverted to the norm of adversarial bargaining, heavy-handed supervision, speed-up and offshore production, and what reaction of its unions has had. The second place award for Best Audio, Podcast, or Radio Broadcast went to a show we did November 10th on defending public education in Kansas City. The show was hosted by Chris Mann and Veronica McDaniel, and guests included Joyce McCauley, Monica Thomas, and Shirley Shivagu, all teachers in the KCMO district, plus administrator Natalie Allen. The hosts and guests talked about the good things happening in the Kansas City schools to counter the waves of bad publicity and longtime habit of bashing the KCMO schools. They talked about winning accreditation, the diverse programs including Montessori, foreign languages, robotics, and community partners. They talked about why it's important to defend public education and much more. The International Labor Communications Association will hold its annual conference and awards banquet later this month in St. Louis. To listen to the winning shows, go to our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, Greg Swartz, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Give us your tired and weak, and we will make them strong. Bring us your far-run songs, and we will sing along. Leave us your broken dreams, we'll give them time to mend. There's still a lot of love living in the promised land. Living in the promised land, our dreams are made of steel. The prayer of every man is to know how freedom feels. There is a winding road across the shifting sand, and room for everyone. Living in the promised.
Welcome to KKFI Heartland Labor Forum and our discussion of what ADAPT, a grassroots disability activist community, did in Washington, D.C. Our guests are Greg Brana, a policy person for the Center for Disability Rights in Rochester, New York, and Mike Oxford, the executive director of the Topeka Independent Living Resource Center in Topeka, Kansas. And my name is Lon Swearingen, and we are all members of ADAPT. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lon.
And Greg, you're there too?
Yep. How are you doing, Lon?
All right. Mike, would you start off with what we did on Sunday at Jeff Sessions' house and about our demands? And then, Greg, would you give us a background information on what we did on Monday, how early we started, and the building we wound up in?
Sure.
Go ahead, Mike.
Sure. Thanks, Lon. So, you know, the overall reason we wanted to get Attorney General Sessions' attention is we just hadn't seen any work or effort, involved with Americans with Disabilities Act protections around the Olmstead decision, which gives people a right to live outside of institutions if that's what they want to do. And so, you know, there's just kind of been radio silence. And, you know, we quoted him that, laws are going to be enforced faithfully, effectively, and impartially. And, you know, our laws are on the books, they're civil rights, and we didn't want them ignored. So, you know, and another more specific kind of thing that we had to look at is ongoing serious deficits in emergency services for people with disabilities, particularly people with disabilities that are in the community, are still being scattered around and, you know, placed in less integrated settings and so on. So those are the overall things, and we wanted Attorney General Sessions to do four basic things. You know, acknowledge that unwanted institutionalization denies Americans with disabilities constitutional rights to liberty. We wanted him to work with our group ADAPT and the disability rights community at large to pursue high-profile ADA Olmstead enforcement actions in every state to address the unnecessary institutionalizations of thousands of people of all ages in nursing facilities.
Okay.
We also, following up on the Judge Rottenberg Center from Boston, Massachusetts, to work with us and the autistic self-advocates to stop the torture of people with disabilities and the Judge Rottenberg Center in Canton, Massachusetts, who are subjected to painful electric shocks and other aversive so-called therapies. And finally, to work with ADAPT and the National Council on Independent Living to address unnecessary and unwanted institutionalization that results when communities are impacted by natural disasters. So those are the specifics, pretty important stuff, and we felt like we needed to really try to amplify our getting of his attention.
Right. And Greg, would you then give us some background information on what we did on Tuesday, or Monday, amendment?
Sure. I mean, on Monday, there was a scheduled hearing for the Graham-Cassidy Amendment, which was part of the effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And ADAPT has been opposing these efforts since, well, before they even dropped in March. We went down to the Capitol Rotunda to protest the House vote on this, and we occupied that on March 23rd. After that, we went back to McConnell's office on June 22nd as the Senate version of the bill was being released, and that sort of started what became known as the Summer of ADAPT, in which we had, on average, I think about three actions a day across 30 states in multiple cities to prevent this awful bill that would devastate Medicaid, which so many disabled people rely on. You know, if you cut $800 billion from Medicaid, which is what this bill proposed, you're going to force people into nursing facilities because those services, the services in nursing facilities are fixed and not optional, whereas home and community-based services, which most people want, are optional. So the first thing to get cut are the optional services.
Right.
And so that covered throughout, that covered the entire summer. And then, as we hear, you know, we thought we'd defeated it when we were there in July at the Hart Building, but it rose again. And you know, we heard that, you know, Graham-Cassidy came up, and it was just as bad, if not worse, than the previous versions. So ADAPT went back, and we showed up. We left our hotel at 4:30 in the morning on Monday and got in line to get into the hearing. We were actually the first ones in line, beating even the paid line sitters that the lobbyists hire. And
that was around 7:30, wasn't it, that we got in the building?
That we got into the building at 7:30. That's when they opened it up.
And then what was the meeting?
We were
time.
There before that, yes. And then we got into the hearing, and there were about, and Mike can probably verify
right.
this.
Wait a second. In other words, we went from 7:30 to 2 o'clock, basically waiting for the meeting to start, right?
Right.
And then
right.
we
and
got
in the meantime,
into
the halls filled up all the way around, packed with people, and spilled clear over into the Hart building, into the next tenant office building, and trailed into there. There were thousands of people in the halls, and almost all of them there to protest the bill. It was unbelievable. And, you know, just a lot of people and a lot of police. And
right now, when you got into Mike, when you got into the room, what was it like? Did you see, how many senators do you recognize there?
Well, when we got into the room, things happened, you know, pretty quickly. So, you know, by the time I got done fiddling around trying to park my scooter over, because we were trying to make as much room as possible,
right?
Pack people, as many people in as we could, which wasn't that many. There wasn't a lot of space. But I could see, you know, Hatch. I could see Robert. You know, it wasn't a real big room.
Right.
And about two-thirds of it was press.
Yeah, almost all of it was press inside. It was filled with tables with press people sitting there with laptops.
Right.
I mean, there were more press people in there than there were.
Now, with that, when you were in there and the meeting started, what happened? And I'm going to give some background on this. So just wait a second. Go ahead.
No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty. No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty. No cuts to Medicaid.
I'm not resisting, I'm just not cooperating. It's also resisting. Gotta stand up.
Medicaid, save our liberty. No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty.
So now what we've done is caused trouble. Now what happens? Can you tell us what went on? Right after that?
Right. Well, I mean, basically, as soon as the gavel came down, those of us that could see each other kind of looked at each other, made eye contact, and everyone kind of like gathered their breath and started chanting that chant as loud as we could. And it was definitely very disruptive. You know?
Right.
It definitely stalled the whole thing out, and I think at the same time, you know, people outside also went on cue, and there was incredible noise from the outside. It was all really kind of, to me, like a great big blend.
Right. Now, what happened
really
to
was,
the people
really
inside,
outside.
Mike? What happened to the people yes. inside?
Ah, well, so, you know, they came to get us out of there pretty darn quickly. You know, I mean, within minutes.
Right.
Because, I mean, the police were right there. Maybe we didn't even get 2 minutes. I don't know. They were in there right away. And the kind of the first person I remember they came to was Josue, and he's sitting there, and he has his chair off, and they can't figure out how to move it. And they're doing all this stuff with him, right, yelling at him, whatever. And ultimately, they pick him up, and out he goes, and they still are trying to move his chair. So they kind of went down the line. I was in deep, came to me, the same sort of routine. I wouldn't operate the scooter. I don't know. The guy I had, I think, was smart enough to figure out that all he had to do was, like, push that lever and it would go.
Right.
So, you know, out we went.
Okay, what were
then,
the charges,
people, they
Mike?
What
did you guys get charged with?
Around a corner and kind of kept us separated out from the people being arrested in the hallway.
Right.
And then they took us away to, like, a lockup. It's basically a converted garage, it looked like.
Right.
And held us
They told us this is where they keep the bomb squad materials.
Yeah. And they kept us there, I think, from start to finish before the last of us got out, because we all kind of stayed together. It was, like, 9 or 10 hours.
Right, so what were you charged with?
We were charged with the unlawful disruption of Congress.
Right, disruption of Congress.
Okay,
which,
so that's what that was.
To be quite honest, was a new one to us.
Mm.
We're not aware of ADAPT dealing with this particular thing before, but, you know, our lawyers are working on it.
All right. I'm going to do something here, just a minute here. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on KKF 90.1 Community Radio, and we're talking with Greg Burton and Mike Oxford. Now, after that, the group outside the room were arrested, but they didn't go with you guys, right?
No, they were all... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Greg. Go ahead.
No, they were all processed outside in what's called an expedited process. It's something that they try and do to make things as easy on themselves as much as us. And so, you know, the Capitol Police have dealt with us for many years, and this is one of the things they've developed recently to try and, you know, when there are large numbers of arrests, to try and make things go a bit faster.
All right.
So, I mean, we had a total of 117 arrested that day from
ADAPT.
That's
a specific thing. They said 181. I guess that included the ones that for inside. I'm not sure.
One of the 181 were including everyone.
Yeah,
117 adapters.
All right. Okay, that's all I meant was I heard 181, but that's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that we were up there for, not only this, but we did one other thing, the Disability Integration Act. Could one of you explain that act and what it would do for people?
Well, sure. I mean, Greg can get into details, but I can tell you that conceptually, it was to give people an absolute legal right to home and community-based services if they otherwise qualified for institutional services. And, you know, basically services that would have to, meet people's needs, not some real limited package that only serves some people. And so we wanted that as a right without regard to funding stream. So if Medicaid did get block granted, if Medicare did start paying for long-term services, if the private insurance market ever comes up with better products and private insurance pays for it, then it would, you know, be required, you know, in all those instances. And so without regard to kind of the changing landscape of what's going to pay for things, it would be a right that people would have. So that's conceptually, you know, what we're after. And, you know, and then we did put in a lot of careful language to solve current problems like waiting lists, like people being served, some labeled groups getting services, others not, inadequate packages of services, you know, especially maybe, you know, and as compared between groups, too, you know, just a lot of inequities and, just meet people's needs so people can, you know, live and be free and thrive in the community, which is what everyone wants.
Right. And then, you know how many sponsors we have now? Or we've got some in the House, too, right?
Right. Right now in the House, I believe we have 53. And in the Senate, we have 16. And... You know, the bill numbers, if people want to call and urge their senators and representatives to sign on to the bill numbers are H.R. 2472 and S-910.
Okay. So those are the two. And the Senate is the 910, and what was the other number?
2472.
And that's the House version. Is that right?
Yes, that's the House version.
All right. So that's where we're at.
It is bipartisan legislation. The House version is sponsored by Representative Sensenbrenner, who's a Republican, and the Senate version is sponsored by Senator Schumer, who's a Democrat. So this is not partisan legislation. It is bipartisan and really shouldn't be something that should get caught up in any partisan fights.
And so basically this is a Civil Rights Act. Is that correct?
Yes, for people with disabilities. And that, you know, that cuts across almost every, you know,
right,
sector, class, race, age, gender. I mean, you name it; it cuts across everything.
And it would include people. Would a person that has insurance would have basically go in a put in a nursing home could stay out with this bill passed? Is that correct?
Right. If you had, like, that's basically the idea. So if you had long-term care insurance now that only paid for nursing home, you know, the bill would say, well, your insurance has to also offer you coverage for home and community services.
All right. I want to thank both of you for this call and the information you've given us. And I hope that we can get something else going. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks,
Vaughn. All right, bye-bye.
Nice talking with you, Greg.
This is Diana Lynn, volunteer programmer and host of the Tasty Brew Music Radio Show. KKFI's next pledge drive starts soon. We come to you on air 3 times a year requesting your financial support for your 24/7 streaming 100,000-watt voice of the community. Won't you please consider showing your financial support as well as lending us your ears when you hear those familiar words from our programmers and on-air volunteers to dial 888-931-0901 or donate securely online at kkfi.org. KKFI, for nearly 30 years, giving a voice to the music and public affairs underserved or ignored by other media outlets. Thanks for listening to KKFI, your community radio.
Fellow workers on the railroad, get your head out of the sand about if and when they're gonna run one man. There's a union culture of scabbery between the UTU and the BLET. Well, Casey Jones, there's a lot of them around. Casey Jones won't put the reverser down. Oh, Casey's gonna stick it to me and you if we let him run trains with a one-man crew. This is the way Mr. Deb said it would be if we kept up with jurisdiction scabbery. The carriers have it just the way they like with our 13 unions just itching for a fight. Back in the day, hell, we should have merged, and I'm here to tell you we were actually on the verge of organizing a union with incredible might. Now all we have is one hell of a plight. Well, Casey Jones, there's a lot of them around. Casey Jones won't put the reverser down. Oh, Casey's gonna stick it to me and you if we let him run train with a one-man crew.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and that was John Paul Wright's rework of the classic labor song, Casey Jones. So, speaking of the railroads, can any of you listening remember when we had a rail strike in this country? There's a good list of strikes on Wikipedia, and they list no rail strikes since 1986 in the United States. It's different in other countries. In fact, English railway workers went on strike yesterday. U.S. workers in transportation are governed by the Railway Labor Act, which was passed in 1926. That law gave them some long-sought-after rights, but it essentially stripped them of the right to strike. And over the years, as rail corporations got bigger and more concentrated, the companies have used their increased power to essentially go workerless, often putting remaining crews and the public at risk. Part of the problem for the rail workers is the structure of their unions. Railway unions were some of the first national unions in our history. And the history of rail strikes, which became sometimes general strikes, is both heroic and tragic. But the sacrifices that railway workers made in the 19th century to win some rights and better jobs in the 20th century are now being eroded because in the 21st century, rail workers are wondering if there are going to be any jobs left at all. But all along the workforce, unity has been shattered by dozens of unions, each of which claims to go after better rules and conditions for their members, and they're all competing with each other. While many of the unions have merged, rail labor is still fragmented between shop workers, track workers, and operating workers, and current negotiations, like so many previous ones, are interminable, and unions are divided. With us to sort all this out and share his vision of rail union unity is Matt Mortensen, a.k.a. Morty. He's an internal organizer and local president of Local 2403 of the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Division. He's also a welder at BNSF. Welcome to the show, Morty.
Thank you for having me, Jenny.
So, first off, tell us what you do for a living.
Back in February, the BMWD, they hired me to be an internal organizer. And the reason being is two and a half years ago, our president, Freddie Simpson, realized that he needs to be completely transparent on what's going on with negotiations. And then back during the election, everyone knows what happened there, that he says, all right, now we're in trouble. So he hired six more, and that's when I came on in February. My job is to go across the country and communicate to all members of what's going on with our negotiations.
Okay. And so you left the tools behind, and what did you do for the railroad?
I was a welder for 12 years, welded on frogs and thermites.
And frogs and thermites are? They're not animals.
No. Frogs is going from one track to another. Sorry.
Okay. Is that dangerous work?
It's extremely dangerous. I mean, you're relying on signals and everything to keep you safe. You're relying on train crews not to run through Form Bs, which is a form of protection. You have hazard materials driving by you all the time. You don't know what's in those tank cars. You have creosote ties that are known to cause skin cancer. And then when you frog well, the fumes off there are known to cause Parkinson's. So that's just some of the many hazards.
And you're out there, outside, working on the track. That's what your union members do, Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way. You maintain the railway, right, the track?
Yep, we maintain the track, make sure okay. The trains stay on.
So, okay, you're one of how many unions in the rail industry?
One of 13.
13 unions. There used to be dozens of them, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. I think there was like 32 at one time.
So give us a little overview. Who are these unions?
And
how do they group together?
Okay, in our current negotiations, the way it is, they got three coalitions. So you have the big coalition that makes up 58%, so that's the UTU and the BLE, which is the conductor and engineers. You got Signal, you have the firemen and oilers, the dispatchers, and the boilermakers. They're in the ones. So they make up the big percentage of them. And then the second biggest is the carmen, the machinists, and the electrical workers and the clerks. And then there's ours, which is the smallest coalition, is the BMWD, the Maintenance of Way, and the mechanics.
Okay, and one of the issues that I've heard you all feel strongly about is this thing called PTC, Positive Train Control.
Yes.
What's that?
Positive Train Control is something that's mandated by the federal government, and what it's supposed to do is when a train is coming up to a signal and it's not slowing down, when it's got a red signal at appropriate time, it will actually shut down the train. And it also, like I said earlier, our Form Bs and everything, it's supposed to stop them before they hit our Form B. But now you have a computer that's operating, and everybody knows that computers fail all the time. And it was actually supposed to be in Class 1 railroads in full effect in 2015, but the railroads, they've got enough money to extend that.
So wait a sec. So the PTC takes the place of the engineer?
Pretty much.
And the PTC, though, doesn't pay union dues and doesn't get a salary,
nope,
right?
No, it's just a computer.
It's just a computer. Sounds real good from the point of view of the railroad.
No. The railroad, yeah, they like it, of course.
Okay. So basically, this has to do with what you, the issue that you all refer to as the one-man crew, is that
yeah.
right? Okay. So they want to run a railroad with a whole train with one guy?
Yeah. Which is okay. extremely dangerous, because now you got one guy out there that's looking out for our safety when we're working on the tracks. And, the other thing is, too, is because we have rail retirement. If they get rid of that one guy, there's that one less person per train that's paying into rail retirement. So it affects every one of these 13 different unions.
Yeah, that, I guess that's a consideration. I think probably from the public's point of view, they're going to be concerned about wrecks, right?
Oh, yeah. Public safety is a huge issue.
Yeah. I mean, these trains these days carry all kinds of lethal chemicals, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Nuclear waste, oil.
Oh.
Yeah, all sorts of things that burn.
Blow
and they're going to have one man on. How many cars does a train have these days?
Oh, depends. There's some that have up to 300 cars.
Really?
So they get pretty long.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Okay, so that's one of the issues that I assume all of you would care about because that's going to reduce a lot of personnel, especially for the operating people, right?
Exactly.
Okay. What other issues do railroad workers have in common today?
Our big thing with all these 13 different unions, we all pay the same with our health care. And it's a huge fight because these railroads are making billions and billions of dollars and want to take huge concessions in our health care. And when you join a union, you don't think you're going to go backwards in life. But every contract that we've gone through, we keep going further and further, you know, back in life.
They're taking concessions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what are the current – I know you're in negotiations right now, all of you, right? All,
mm-hmm.
all the railroad workers. So what are they demanding as far as your health care?
Well, they want to pay us double. They want us to make us pay double for our deductible, and double out of our out of pocket the bill you get in the mail. So you know, currently we have a 95.5. They want to change that to like a 90.10, and then
so that's pretty. That's still pretty good compared to other workers who are paying a higher percentage, right?
It is really good compared to the rest of the world. But the thing is what we pay is it's ridiculous for any of American to pay that much for health care.
Oh, so you're trying to hold the line and keep your good health care benefits.
Exactly. And we're not just doing it for us. We're doing it also for the middle class. So everybody, mm-hmm. even the middle class that aren't in a union or whatever thing, they gotta show us support because if we go backwards in life, they are too.
Good luck with that. okay, so in these negotiations then, the railroads are demanding the one-man crew, right?
That was a scare, but today... the big coalition, they reached a tentative agreement, and that's one of the deals they struck is they get to keep their two-man crews, but they're going to do huge concessions on our health care.
Who's the other guy on the crew besides the engineer?
The conductor.
Okay. So they kept that. Does that mean and they're the ones who actually represent the engineers and the conductors?
Well, you got the engineers and conductors, which is weird because there's two guys sitting in there. They're actually two different unions. Sitting in one train.
Are they both part of this coalition
yep,
that just
both
made the
in
deal?
The coalition.
Okay, so that's that issue's been taken care of then.
Yeah.
So now you have to fight on the health care. Are there other issues, or is that mainly it?
No, that's it. I mean, they're going to put it out for ratification to their membership, and we'll just see what happens from there.
And how long are these contracts?
They're generally every 3 years.
How long have you been negotiating this contract?
Since January 1st, 2015.
That's 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Is one of
So you have a three-year contract,
yeah.
and then 3 years after it expires, you get a new contract?
Yeah.
So what happens in the meantime? You don't get a raise, right?
No, we haven't had a raise. Our last raise was actually January 1st of 2015.
Is what this other coalition negotiated, is it going to be retroactive?
Yes. So okay. not the wage increases that we'd like to see. Our big thing with health care is... they make billions of dollars. They can afford our health care and leave our health care alone. And they're making money hand over fist off our backs. And enough's enough.
Okay. So your union, the BMWE division of the Teamsters, which is a powerful union.
Yeah.
How do you differ from these guys who just made a deal?
The way that we differ is, like I said, my president, Freddie Simpson, is they all the other two coalitions thinks he's being some extremist by going out there and being public with what's going on with everything. So when
you mean in the past nobody knew what was
going on? No, in the past we've never done this. We've never been public what's going on in negotiations. It's all been private, and then we get a letter in the mail, you know, and it's a ballot to vote yes or no, and that's the way it's always been.
Well, so the members are kept in the dark until they get a settlement, and then they're told vote it up or down?
Yep.
What's the reason behind that? Do you have any idea?
I can't explain the other coalitions. I could just explain that we're doing is because being completely transparent is very important because you get your, you know, knowledge is power. And then you get them, you know, educate and agitate and organize. So, and that's what we're going around talking to other these unions and explain to them what's going on.
So are you telling them what day-to-day is happening in negotiations?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty unusual for American unions Most American unions, when they negotiate contracts, keep a real wrap on the day-to-day negotiations, saying that you can't make a deal in public because you get locked into positions.
Yeah.
And so this is pretty radical to do this.
Yeah, the thing is with our healthcare also, I want to mention is the BMWD, they hired a company called Chiron to find savings in our healthcare, and they actually found over $100 million in savings in our healthcare.
What kind of savings?
Just minor tweaks, and United Healthcare was just wasting money, and they found the waste that United Healthcare, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and that were using. And
health insurance companies wasting money. Yeah. What a shocking
thing. So over $100 million, and when we presented that to the railroads, they said, thanks for finding that, but it's not yours.
It's not yours. We're going to pocket it.
Exactly.
Thank you. Yeah, very nice. Okay, so you're calling for transparency in negotiations, but you also had a unity rally recently that was called by your union, right? Why?
The rally we had recently, it was the machinist, Aaron Dixon, he put that on. He contacted me and wanted me to help organize that and get it together.
Oh, so it wasn't the BMWE, it was the IAM,
The BMWD, we had a rally back in May 3rd, and we had a really good turnout in, like, Chicago, and there was Kansas City was a good one, and then Nashville and Roseville, California. But this last one was, by the machinist, and we helped them out and worked together in solidarity and bring all crafts together and say we're standing strong with our health care.
Okay, and what does the leadership of all these different unions think about your trying to pull the crafts together?
That's kind of like I said earlier, that our president, he put this on, and they think he's just being extreme. And then the way you negotiate is not publicly, and that's not okay. That's really how they feel.
So there should be no contract campaign?
There should be a lot of campaigns. So.
But that's the rationale of the other unions, you're saying. Okay. So... Are the railroads being tougher this time than they have been in the past, or are they always taking this long and stalling the negotiations? And
they've always taken pretty long. I think with our health care, they are being a little tougher, and the reason is because they got Congress on their back. You know, according to RLA, I don't know, with the RLA, you got
Railway Labor Act.
When we get appointed by the PEB, you have the Presidential Emergency Bill.
Thank you.
You have three people appointed by the president, typically two of his party, one of the opposing, and they got the Congress in their back pockets, so they're pretty much saying they don't care.
So, and as I said when we started, you really don't have the right to strike. I mean, you have to go through years of negotiations before you're even released to be able to strike under the Railway Labor Act, right?
Well,
and then they send you back to work as soon as you do because it's a threat to the economy.
Yeah, because when we strike, we shut down more than 50% of this economy. I mean, total of us, there's almost 150,000 of us. If we all go together, this country's in trouble. So.
Yeah, right. So no more rail strikes. Okay, which obviously significantly limits your power at the bargaining table, because if you can't back up your demands with a strike, I mean, this is just basic labor 101. If you can't back up the demands with a strike threat, then you don't get as much.
I mean, like, there is two ways we can strike. You got minor and major disputes, which minor is your grievances. The major is, like, a few years ago, CP Rail, they switched their timekeeping up, their payroll, and there was a group of guys that didn't get paid for a few months, and they that's a major dispute, so they strike then. But the other way is when you reach PEB, when you get released from mediation to a presidential emergency board, you got a 30-day cool-off period, and then you could strike then.
Yeah, and how often does that happen?
Not very often, because you got a judge.
As I said,
you got a judge down.
1980 something or other.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's tough. Okay. So President Trump says that he's going to shut down Amtrak. Does this mean that the railroad companies are in financial trouble?
Oh, no. I mean, the railroads are making money hands over fist. What I like to compare the railroads to is Walmart. When you look at the profit margins of the railroads, they make about average of 20%. And then compared to Walmart, their average is 3%. So they're making money hand over fist. I know people ought to preach so that Amtrak is government funded and everything. And which here in the Midwest, you don't see Amtrak very much, but when you go out the East Coast, they're huge. Yeah. And they're a very profitable company as well.
But they're subsidized, and so
they do get government funding.
Okay. What about the freight haulers? Do they get subsidies?
Freight, no.
No, they're just a pure private corporation.
Yeah.
I bet there's something. I mean, they got the biggest subsidy in American history, which was all the land grant stuff out west when they built the railroads out west.
Oh, yeah, they got a bunch of land back in the day for free.
Yeah, they got all that free land. And you, but the CEOs certainly aren't hurting for money. Your CEO, you don't know who, your CEO doesn't publish his...
Because Warren Buffett bought out BNSF, so now it's not publicly traded. But
this guy, CP?
Yeah, Hunter Harrison.
$24 million a year? That's just salary?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, all these guys, I mean, you got Lance Fritz that's making over $11 million, which he's a UP. And that's not even the board of directors that are below him. So these guys are all making money hand over fist. And they sit there and want to preach to us because coal's down. They're not making money. But my best example is the story by Don Griffin is when they had stock trains. You know, that was their money maker back then. But you don't see them no more. So they'll find a way to make money.
Well, they're hauling a lot of stuff for Walmart. So we've been talking to Matt Mortensen from the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way, Local 2403. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you.
I wish you luck in your negotiations. And may they be transparent so we can talk about them on the news.
Thank you, Judy. Keep us informed.
Thank you.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, West Virginia senior senator not supporting Trump mine safety nominee. From scienceblogs.com/thepumphandle for September 29th. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia, issued a statement last week which said, "While I appreciate Mr. Zaitsolo's willingness to serve, I cannot support his confirmation to leave MSHA, Mine Safety and Health Administration. After reviewing his qualifications and record of safety during his time in the coal industry, I am not convinced that Mr. Zaitsolo is suited to oversee the federal agency that implements and enforces mine safety laws and standards." Senator Manchin was governor of West Virginia during the 2006 disaster at Sago Mine that killed 12 coal miners and the 2010 coal dust explosion at Upper Big Branch Mine that killed 29 men. Ken Ward at the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette was first to report on David Zaitsolo's nomination made public September 2nd. The announcement indicated that Zaitsolo most recently served as chairman of Rhino Resources, a publicly traded coal mining and oil gas extraction firm. The Gazette reporter described some of the mine safety happenings while Zaitsolo was at Rhino Resources, including the company had a series of run-ins with MSHA over serious safety violations. In the midst of MSHA warnings over a pattern of violations at the Eagle No. 1 West Virginia mine, Joseph Cassell, 33, was fatally injured. At the firm's CAM mine, No. 28, Pike County, Kentucky, MSHA had evidence of a manager giving miners advance notice that an inspector was at the mine, illegal under the Mine Act. Next, OSHA cites Chicago container manufacturer after four workers suffer injuries. From www.osha.gov, news release for September 25th. A Chicago manufacturer of rigid metal, plastic, and hybrid containers faces $503,000 in proposed penalties after inspectors from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, responded to four separate reports of workers suffering injuries. As a result of its investigation, OSHA cited B-Way Corporation for 5 repeat and 5 serious safety violations of machine safety procedures and placed the company in its severe violator enforcement program. In the past 5 years, 15 workers suffered amputations at the Chicago plant. OSHA found one employee suffered 2 broken bones in his hand after it was crushed by a piece of equipment. 3 other employees suffered amputations from unguarded chain and sprocket assemblies. The agency issued repeat citations for failing to train workers in lockout-tagout procedures that prevent unintentional machine movement, and inadequate machine guarding on mechanical power press, belts and pulleys, and chains and sprockets. The five serious citations involve failing to lock out equipment prior to clearing jams and inadequate machine guarding. The company has 15 business days from receipt of citations and penalties to comply, request an informal conference with OSHA area director, or contest the findings. Finally, dairy workers suffocating in manure, from the Confined Space blog at jordanbarab.com for September 27th. Tim Craig has written a very good, if disturbing, article in the September 24th Washington Post about hazardous conditions for dairy farmers in Idaho. Alberto Navarro Munoz had been working on the farm for only 2 weeks, September last year, when he encountered one of the most gruesome hazards that a dairy worker can face. His tractor tipped over into a pit of cow manure, submerging the Mexican native under several feet of loose, thick, somewhat liquid-like substance, according to the police report documenting his death in southern Idaho. Farms have become increasingly reliant on immigrant workers who often have minimal training or experience dealing with dangerous equipment and large animals. That has left farm laborers especially vulnerable to workplace deaths, such as being electrocuted, crushed by tractors, kicked by a heifer, or beat up by a bull. And statistics bear out anecdotal tragedies. There were 6,700 injuries on dairy farms with 11 or more employees in 2015, a rate more than double the average for private industry. On those farms, 43 laborers died. Due to a 40-year-old congressional budget writer, OSHA is not allowed to set foot on farms that have 10 or fewer employees. The Post article states that Idaho employees are making an effort to address the problem. The Idaho Dairymen's Association has budgeted $250,000 to train state dairy workforce. Worker advocates are skeptical. Indira Trejo, Global Impact Coordinator for the United Farm Workers, said the danger of manure lagoons is just one of the numerous threats facing dairy workers. Her organization has received scores of complaints from dairymen who say they are overworked and have limited access to safety training and bathrooms. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Empower Missouri, persisting and organizing to win. It's their 2017 annual conference, and it's Thursday, October 5th. That's today, and Friday, tomorrow, and I probably should have taken this off because it's in St. Louis. Never mind. Next Tuesday, Kansas City AFL-CIO is doing a special training that's open to activists, union members, and activists. It's the Common Sense Economics Training, and it's going to be focusing on messaging on right to work. This is going to be at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, October 10th at the Argosy Casino Conference Area. And if you are interested in going, you need to go to MissouriCSE.com to register. Racial Justice Poster Show and Fundraiser brought to you by Ray Gun to benefit Standing Up for Racial Justice, Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, One Struggle KC, and Any Town. Thursday, October 12th, 5 to 7 p.m., 1803 Baltimore Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. League of Women Voters fundraiser showing the film The Life and Times of Barbara Jordan. Thursday, October 12th, 7 p.m., Community Christian Church, 4601 Main Street. To register, go to LWV, that's League of Women Voters, KC, LWVKC.org. Self-inflicted wounds. Why America's healthcare system costs so much and works so poorly. Community of Reason with James Webb, Sunday, October 15th at 1 o'clock p.m., UMKC, Royal Hall, Room 301. And the third Saturday Democratic Breakfast with candidates for Wyandotte County Mayor and Commissioners, Saturday, October 21st, 8 a.m. for breakfast, 9 a.m. for presentations at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue, KCK. RSVP to ScottMackey08 at yahoo.com. That's it for the Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. Our show is called The Right to Protest, a Roundtable Discussion. It's also Pledge Week, so get your money ready. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.